This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Down producing. And your number, 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We're visiting in studio with the esteemed pollster Bernie Pinsonad and telephonically with Tony Brown, Alexandria talk show host and media mogul. And they are here to talk about the world of politics in Louisiana 24 days from the October 14th primary. And whoever the next governor is, looks like he or she will inherit a $1.1 billion obligation to Southern University. Today's story above the fold in the Advocate and Picayune, citing longstanding funding inequities between Southern and LSU, the federal government urged state officials to restore $1.1 billion. It says Southern has lost over the past three decades, a move likely to hearten advocates of historically black colleges and universities. Now, Governor Edwards, Commissioner of Administration Jay Darden, is trying to discern what's going on here, and I'm sure there will be challenges to this, but $1.1 billion is real money. And Tony Brown, let's start with you. This will be a big windfall for Southern, but it could be a hole in the budget for the next governor. What do you think?
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. Bernie, nice to be on a panel with you this morning. You know, as you mentioned before, because of the disparities financially as it pertains to the economics of Southern University, the only system that's from an HBCU in the entire country, I think it's not much needed money. I think it's going to help Southern in a big way, not only from a standpoint of moving forward with their agenda, but also is going to help economically in the Baton Rouge area. You know, we've been in deficits before. I don't like the fingers being directed at this $1.1 billion that's going to be allocated at Southern, because, you know, we knew this was coming down the pike, and this is just yet another thing that the state's going to have to deal with just to make it right. This is a good thing. And it's a just thing, and it's a long time coming.
Well, Bernie, maybe Southern will build a billion-dollar football stadium.
Or they can pay their coach $50 million a year.
That's right, and keep up with the Kellys. Now, we say this somewhat facetiously, but obviously, as Brian Kelly said last week or a couple of weeks ago, LSU emphasizes athletics, and obviously, athletics are king when it comes to the old war school. I usually don't do this, but I, as you know, I get letters and emails, and I got an interesting note. I just showed it to Bernie. Just open the envelope. It's $4, as in $4 $1 bills, and the note says, "Please return Brian's $4 tip at pastime. Hope he never wins." So I assume somebody was insulted by the tip. Now, if he went in and he had a $10 meal and he left a $4 tip, that'd be fine. But if he had a $100 meal and left a $4 tip, that would not be good. But somebody got upset at pastime, Bernie. Place I think that you know pretty well.
I do know it very well.
But Ryan Kelly apparently hangs out at pastime, and he must have upset somebody who works there.
He won't be hanging out there any longer.
This is unsigned, by the way, so I'm always a little suspicious, but it's sent to me. So there we go. And the $4, somebody just sent me $4, and I don't really hang out with Brian Kelly, so maybe some of our Tiger Rag people will be able to give it to him. 877-217-5757. But I remember back in the last gubernatorial cycle, Ed Orgeron endorsed John Bel Edwards for re-election and caught some heat. I haven't seen Brian Kelly endorse anybody, Bernie, but today at Louis Cafe, speaking of another fine restaurant, one of the longstanding ones, I saw one Jeffrey Martin Landry holding court at Louis Cafe. I said, with that smile, you look like Hubert Humphrey. You're the new Republican happy warrior. Does he have reason to smile, Bernie Pinsonat?
Well, obviously he does. He continues to dominate in the polls. All of this was a culmination of what he put together. He got the Republican Party, he got Trump, he got Cassidy, he got all of the major players to endorse him. And the governor's race has really not been a big event on people's you know, in Louisiana as it used to be. So there's not a lot of attention being paid. It'll probably pick up, but some of the predictions now, it may be well under 50%. We're still not there yet, but Jeff's position with all the endorsements he has put him in a commanding position. That doesn't mean it'll be that way election day, but if you look at him today, he's obviously doing very well.
Well, I think most of the candidates who are trying to get in the runoff, and presuming there will be a runoff, they're hopeful that they can get past Sean Wilson. They feel like Landry has pretty much locked up one slot. But Sean Wilson is a Democrat. There are two other Democrats on the ballot, by the way. And yesterday at the press club of Baton Rouge, Ron Fauché, Dr. Fauché, noted that 40% of the people in his poll are not familiar with Sean Wilson. So he's the last guy on the ballot. Could be a case in which some other Democrats get votes almost by default. But Tony Brown, is Sean Wilson a shoe-in to make a runoff come November 18th with one Jeff Landry?
Well, it's interesting you said that. I don't think he's a shoe-in. I don't even think that Jeff Landry is a shoe-in as governor, although he's been running for governor for the last 4 years that he was an attorney general. He has more money than anybody out there. But I was looking at this poll that came out certainly in the media today, this great television poll that talks about likability. I think likability is going to be a factor. I told you when you and I had a discussion last week that, you know, I'm African-American. I am a Democrat. My wife, however, is a Republican. She's also African-American. But we feel, both of us, that Jeff Landry is not talking to us. You know, I feel conflicted that he has snubbed his nose at any forum that had anyone who organized it that was from a traditionally African-American organization, whether it was the Urban League recently or the big religious forum that they had at Southern University a month ago. He failed to show up there. And his primary reasons of not going to these forums is because that they have African-American participation in the sponsorship. I don't get it. I don't understand how someone can expect to try to be the governor for all of the people of Louisiana and not talk to a third of its population being African-American. So I'm conflicted about his lack of support, his lack of coming to forums where he may have to entertain some questions from an African-American audience or a black on African-American format. I don't know if Sean is a shoe-in. I don't think anything is a shoe-in, but I think he has a better chance than anybody else of making the runoff. And according to that great TV poll that came out in The Advocate this morning, they say that his percentages are pretty good.
What do you think that you'll be supporting him? Is he a guy you can vote for?
Oh, absolutely. I've had several conversations with him, not only in person, but also here on my show. I think his message of unity in a country that has been polarized for at least the past 4 years or more is a message that people want to hear. I don't care what color you are in Louisiana. If you want to move this state forward, we're going to have to do it together. You know, we're better together than we are apart. And this bipartisan politics is really... people are tired of it. I'm tired of it. You know, I may be a registered Democrat, but I don't vote along party tickets. I never have. I vote on what's best for me and my family, and I think most Louisianans do the same thing. So I don't care what color you are. I don't care what party you're from. If your platform is going to be conducive to me and my family, you have my vote. If you have the same sort of values, and I am a Christian, and I am very conservative when it comes to some issues. I'm liberal on some issues. I'm kind of like on the fence, you know. But you can't define me as being a liberal African-American because I'm a Democrat.
All right. Well, I want to get Bernie's take on this before we hit the break. Many may not recall, but when Jeff Landry was elected attorney general 8 years ago in 2015, he was running against a Republican. He beat Buddy Caldwell, and he did so with African-American support. Cleo Fields was backing him, and I think Landry won that election in large part because of Senator Fields and some others. So he relied upon African-American support to get to the gig he's got now. And now he's the solid front runner for governor as a conservative Republican. Do you sense, Bernie, as somebody who I think has a favorable opinion of Attorney General Landry, that he's neglecting the black vote?
Well, he can certainly be accused of that, and the black voters probably have that feeling about him. But the reality is, and this has nothing to do with taking up for him, because Tony's points, I'm not going to argue with him. They were on point, especially if you're an African-American voter. But the reality is, this is a governor's race. It's not the attorney general. It's a much more defined race as far as candidates and where they're aligned politically. John Bel Edwards got, 97% of all the black vote?
He did. And we'll be back with Bernie Pinsonet and Tony Brown after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and your number 877-217-5757. 24 shopping days to go between now and October 14th. I think you got it right. Mm-hmm. 21 days on Saturday, so maybe 25, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't have a calendar in front of me, but I think you're right.
It's 25. Yes. But we're getting in the home stretch, and this race is reminiscent. We will go to the phone lines in a moment with Tony Brown and Bernie Pinsonet, but it's reminiscent of 2007. We usually do have surprises in Louisiana governor's elections. I think in 2003, at the start, few people thought Kathleen Blanco would win. 2015, few people thought John Bel Edwards would win. 87, few people thought Charles Elson Buddy Romer would win. But in 2007, Bobby Jindal, he led start to finish. In this race, unless something changes, looks extremely reminiscent of that election, Bernie.
Well, like I said earlier, his campaign is what is impressive.
When you say his, you're talking about
Jindal's campaign has always been very impressive. The way he started out with the Republican Party, which has turned into an ATM machine. Most candidates, most races, no one's ever said, okay, let me go get the Republican Party. Well, we find out how valuable it is because of its ability to literally be the, he can get people to spend a lot of money there, and it's all directed at him. So we call it an ATM machine.
Right.
His campaign is the big difference. It's not that their candidates aren't as good as he is, articulate, all of those things. The only thing that matters right now is that most of the people voting for him is because of what they think he is because of who endorsed him.
All right. Well, Tony Brown in the old days, and we're talking just 15 years ago, candidates used to try to hit all 64 parishes. They'd speak to the Alexandria Kiwanis Club, the Alexandria Rotary Club. Have you seen many of the candidates in your great city of Alexandria this cycle?
Not so many of the gubernatorial candidates. Sean Wilson has been up here extensively. Hunter Lundy as well. Jeff Landry hasn't been up here maybe once or twice that I can speak of. But Sean seems like he's up here every week as well as Hunter Lundry. And you know, we're talking about the gubernatorial candidates, and Hunter Lundy's message is one of unification. You know, he's running as an independent. He makes no bones about his him being a Christian. He is a gospel preacher as well. And he's been coming on my program, and people are gravitating towards his message. So I'm not saying he's going to be a dark horse, no pun intended in this, but, you know, I see in this poll that he has a recognition level has gone up from a single digits to 14% in this new great poll. And I see Sean Wilson, you know, heavily recognized by the African-Americans, just as Jeff Landry is mostly Caucasian voters. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, and Ron Fauché said Jeff Landry in his poll was getting 20% of the black vote, which isn't likely to happen, but it shows that General Landry has been viewed favorably by some in the African-American community, which some might find a bit of a surprise. Daryl in River Bend, I believe this is our friend Daryl Glasper, who was in studio yesterday. Daryl must have something to get off his chest. Good morning, sir.
No, sir. I want to say this. two people that I know, I like, and I respect, and they know how to do numbers. Bernie Pinson, that I've been knowing for a long time. Tony Brown, you've been a very good person to be outspoken. And let me say this, Tony Brown, you just hit it right. You have an attorney general that ignored the African-American community. They said, the Bible said, out of the heart, the abundance of the mouth speak. And he made a mistake. Nobody corrected him. But at least the other Republican candidates did step up and say we were going to attend. But the elephant in the room, Tony, is this. This is a crucial time in this state's history. And we have an African-American that we like. And he's likable. But can he win the governor's race after Cleo Fields set the bar so high in 1995, they should put it as a masterpiece of how an African-American run a campaign. Bill Jefferson, 4 years later, tried. Barack Obama tried in the state twice and couldn't crack 40%. And then you have last year, I think you had the other candidate, Gary Chambers, try to run for Senate. Can an African-American win? And if he can't win, Tony, if he can't win, a vote for Wilson gives you the person who has ignored you. It is a fact.
All right. Your thoughts about Darrell's diatribe, if you will. He says that we're not ready. Unfortunately, we're not ready, according to Darrell and many others, to elect a black person statewide in Louisiana. Is he on the mark or is he off target? Your thoughts, Tony Brown.
Well, I understand what his message is, and I understand what he's saying, and I agree with him to a certain extent. But if not now, when? I mean, the last time we had an African-American in a statewide office, PBS Pinchback, 150 years ago, and he didn't get to stay in office that long. So it's not a matter about he can't win. Let's give the guy a shot and see what he does. That's what I like. I like to see with Sean. I think he would be good for Louisiana. There's white folk who have supported him, who've thrown their hat. There's full support behind him, and one is our governor. So if they could translate some votes for him from Democrats, whether they're black or white, certainly I think he has a better shot than anybody else of getting in the runoff. What happens after he gets in the runoff? Well, that's going to depend upon the voters of Louisiana and certainly trying to mobilize and get that African-American vote out.
Well, PBS Pinchback was a Republican who served as acting governor of Louisiana from December 9th, 1872 to January 13th, 1873, all of 35 days, 5 weeks, and he was not elected.
I stand corrected.
Well,
No,
but he was governor. There's no doubt that
he was.
Pinckney Benton Stewart Pinchback was governor of Louisiana, but we just unfortunately haven't had. And also, and another listener, just as I'm saying this, notes also that Oscar Dunn, another black man, was governor and lieutenant governor, but he was not elected governor either. But Louisiana, in some ways, has been progressive, but this was during Reconstruction, Bernie, and unfortunately, I think we're still fighting some of the same battles we were fighting in 1860.
Well, with the caller's take on Sean Wilson, you can make the argument that he can't win, but why should you say that to anyone because of color?
Well, I remember Mary Landrieu made that argument with Cleo Fields and Senator Fields.
Never forgave her.
Never forgave her, and he had a point.
Well,
that, he felt like that was diminishing his integrity, his credibility, and I understand that.
Well, I would never say that. I mean, does he have a great chance to win? I can't say that. But for him not to run, for a Democrat not to be running, it would be horrible for the Democratic Party. It would be horrible for the black voters with no one out there talking about the problems they face. And he has solutions that he's putting forward. So his candidacy to me is very important.
Rebel in Sherwood. Rebel, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, Jim. And thank you to your guests. I'd like your guests to respond if they could. And I give Mr. Glasper, of course, is a joke. If you care about civil rights, women's rights, voting rights, or simply what is right and wrong, it seems to me that the same folks that voted for John Bel Edwards need to get out and vote for the Democrat, Sean Wilson, so that we can have a divided government.
All right, well, without that, John Bel supporting Sean Wilson, but It was noted yesterday at the press club, and it's been talked about on this show, that in Louisiana in 2020, almost a 500,000 more people voted in the presidential election than did in the governor's election in 2019. And the governor's election was competitive. The presidential election in Louisiana was not. Trump won by 400,000 votes, but Bernie, Joe Biden got 82,000 more votes in defeat than John Bel Edwards received in victory a year earlier for governor. Why aren't we more juiced up about the governor's election in our state?
Well, I think the presidential election has become more about people's feelings about the direction of the country. It's a partisan divide on social issues, partisan divide on taxes, partisan divide on the Supreme Court, you name it. And those are things that people are emotionally involved in because they think about themselves, their families, their grandparents, and their grandkids. But the governor's race is something that it just doesn't generate energy.
We'll return after this quick timeout with more. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with our two guests, Tony Brown in Alexandria, prominent talk host on radio in Sinlaw and a media owner as well, and Bernie Pinsonat, the dean of Louisiana Political Pollsters. 877-217-5757. If you'd like to get under the wire with Bernie and with Tony. And before we go to the break, Daryl Glasper said Sean Wilson will have a difficult time winning because Louisiana just doesn't vote, has never voted for a black person to win a statewide office. But Kip Holden got close 8 years ago. He got 46%. And Bernie and Tony, I think right now, more than race, the problem's having that D beside your name, other than John Bel Edwards. Mm. I don't know of anybody who could have won the last two governor's elections. I think the Democratic brand doesn't play well in Louisiana anymore. Bernie?
Well, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I, as a pollster, started seeing the trends away. In fact, I don't think I saw it, but I was sent a quote I had in the New York Times on, in 20 years, the number of white Democrats in the state capitol will be on.
Well, there are eight left. There are eight.
Well, I said 10.
There are eight.
So and that's the reality today. The voters in Louisiana have turned away from Democrats. The business community with lobby started this stuff years ago, and that's a culmination.
And a listener says, well, hold on, in the major cities of our state, Democrats generally rule, and that is true. That is true. And in our hometown of Baton Rouge, Bernie, the last competitive race in a statewide cycle won by a Republican in East Baton Rouge Parish, in, I believe, was Woody Jenkins. In 1996, he beat Mary Landrieu by a couple of thousand votes, and nobody. Mary Landrieu, in defeat and in a landslide defeat to Bill Cassidy, still carried East Baton Rouge Parish, beating Cassidy in his hometown. Now, Tony Brown, you have a similar situation in Alexandria. So these major urban centers with most of the population, they have Democratic rule, but yet the rural areas, if you look at some of these rural parishes, they went 85, 90, 95% for Donald Trump. And if you carry a big urban area, let's say with 52% of the votes, as Sharon Weston Broome did against Bodie White, and then the other guy is getting 95% in West Carroll, those rural parishes add up to the point where Republicans rule the roost. What do you think, Tony?
Well, you know, traditionally here in Central Louisiana, we are Democrat, and we still are, even in the rural areas. It's just like Joe the Plumber, people who may not be at the high end of the spectrum as it pertains to economics, but are voting, you know, really along what the national trend is. We saw Rodney Alexander almost 25 years ago run as a Democrat as soon as he got into office. It was the first time I saw it. He switched to Republican. We have a sheriff who's run for re-election here, and Mark Wood, who ran the last 4 years ago as a Democrat as soon as he got into office, he switched to Republican. So we've seen the trend of people who are traditional Democrat running as Republicans. And then we have the voters who are still Democrat, but guess what? They're voting Republican. And that's what we're seeing here in Central Louisiana and many other rural areas of Louisiana, in my opinion.
And shame on Rodney Alexander. He beat Lee Fletcher by an eyelash and then switched parties. And, and Rodney Alexander, like two members of our current congressional delegation, did not have a college degree. And I must say that every major candidate in the governor's race has a college degree. Most of them are very well educated. Sean Wilson has a PhD. Jeff Landry is a lawyer. Richard Nelson's a lawyer and an engineer. Sharon Hewitt's an engineer. John Schroeder's a graduate, proud graduate of Southeastern Louisiana University. And Stephen Wagaspak has a law degree. So we've got a well-educated group of candidates running for governor, and we have had some extremely smart governors. Craig in Natchitoches, you're on as we head to the finish line with Tony Brown and Bernie Pinsonet. Hey, Craig.
A couple of questions. One, I've been trying to find some polling on the state Senate District 31 race between Mike McConathy and Alan Seaball, and I haven't been able to find any polling on that. The other question is, if John Bel Edwards could run for a third term, do you think he would win?
I think he'd have a fighting chance.
Yeah, you can't rule him out. But here's what his advantage is. He knows the Republicans. If there's a way for them to shoot each other's toes off, there's a probability that they would. I predicted that John Bel Edwards would have a hard time being reelected, except for the fact that the Republicans would probably reelect him, and they did.
All right. Well, what about the McConathy Seaball race? Tony, do you know anything about that? That's one of those. You got Republican and heavy Republican. What do you think?
Well, I haven't heard much of these guys, you know, and rightfully so. So I'd like to call up in Natchitoches. There's not a lot of information out there about this particular
Bernie?
Race.
Bernie?
Well, a lot of the lobbyists, a lot of people polling it, I think early on, the coach had a lead over Alan Seaball, but it was primarily because he was a basketball coach and he was well known. Then we had the coach come out and say he voted for John Bel Edwards. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. So I think it's pretty close right now, but there's a lot of money to be spent. Alan Seaball is a good candidate. Coach is apparently a good candidate. So it's close.
David in Atlanta, final caller for Tony and Bernie. David, please be concise.
Fewer parents are having their children vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella. Is this a product of the inferior educational system in Louisiana, or have the people been brainwashed by the mega Republicans?
Mega or MAGA? Maybe both, but I don't know about brainwashing, but we do have some anti-vaxxers out there, and Tony Brown, Bernie Pinsonet, were both of you vaccinated for COVID?
Sure, I was.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
And I'm taking the next one as soon as he comes in as well.
Me too.
I think generally vaccinations are good, but some people don't like them. And I guess the question is, should they be forced to have them if they don't want them? That's where the government comes into play. And
And I agree with that assessment, Jim. Let me just say something about the Natchitoches caller. If John Bel ran again, would he win? I don't think he would get as much African-American support as he got last time because of the Ronald Green factor, the cover-up, that debacle. And still to this day, he never did give an explanation as to why that happened or take account for it. So I think there's quite a few African-Americans who are enlightened and know what's going on with that particular case. And John Bel would have a problem this time around.
Well, in Arkansas, which elected a slew of moderate to liberal Democratic governors, from Bill Clinton to Dale Bumpers to David Pryor to Jim Guy Tucker, and now recently has gone Republican, Mike Beebe, another one, kind of a John Bel Edwards type who served two terms. Now the governor there is Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and the story in the New York Times of a few days ago when Governor Sanders summoned Arkansas lawmakers to Little Rock for a special session to cut taxes and ban the state from mandating COVID-19 vaccination. She added another request, overhaul the state's longstanding Freedom of Information Act. They don't care about transparency. Sanders, the Republican whose father was governor,
who took office in January, said, referring to people she saw as taking advantage of the law, which gives any resident of the state the right to have access to government records. They want to waste taxpayer dollars, slow down our bold conservative agenda, and frankly put my family's lives at stake. Well, guess what? The Republican legislature said, no way, Sarah, go home on this one. So she lost.
Rightly so.
And for those who have fears that a particular candidate will do something like that in Louisiana, as Bernie just said, Republicans are like Democrats used to be. They fight with each other. And some of these things, they have one eye on their constituents, as they should. And the constituents might not like some of these things. And the elephant in the room, Jeff Landry, is his bark worse than his bite, Bernie, or do you know, or do we know?
Well, we don't know because he's where he is because of all the endorsements, the superior organization he put together. Everything about him is he's gotten to where he is with incredible campaign. I don't care what you say about him. His campaign has been one of the best I've ever seen put together, and that's why he is where he is. He hasn't gone out and done a lot of promising about what's he going to change or the Constitution, all these things. He's getting by with who likes him. And I mean, that's important.
All right. Period. Now, you started out by saying you had concerns about Attorney General Landry. Really, a lot of these positions that he is stating are certainly echoed by many of the other candidates in the race. Why is he more fearful to you than, say, Sharon Hewitt or John Schroeder or Stephen Waguesback, Tony Brown?
I like Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. Nungesser is a Republican. I'm a Democrat. I've had him on my show. I've sat down with him. When a colleague of his, in a Jeff Landry, goes public to the news media in Baton Rouge and the like and says that Jeff Landry is a bad guy, if you have a white guy who's a Republican saying that another white guy who's a Republican is a bad guy, I'm more apt to listen to that guy. And that was his assessment, Billy Nungesser, who I respect and who I like, as a true Republican, said about Jeff Landry, and I'll just leave that at that point.
Okay, but
what about Bill Cassidy?
They've kissed and made up, and Cassidy endorsed Landry. Cassidy, the ultimate anti-Trumper in Louisiana from the Republican ranks, endorsed the ultimate pro-Trumper in Jeff Landry. But when I asked Jeff Landry several weeks ago at another one of those confabs at Louis Cafe, how he and Nungesser kissed and made up, his response, Bernie and Tony, was, "It's amazing what a little holy water will do."
Well, I know what Billy is saying publicly, but I know where his heart is, and you know, the first thing out of someone's mouth about somebody that he made public, and normally this guy's reserved as what he says out in public. He had no problem saying that.
All right, we got to roll, but we'll be back with more after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. As we round the turn and head for home, Catherine Blunt is with us, joining us from San Francisco, where she resides and reports for the Wall Street Journal. She is an environmental reporter, has written about utilities and renewable energy for the Wall Street Journal since 2018. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago and also has won many other awards for something that many journalists are not very good at, and that's reporting business. But she is a specialist, and many in this area may remember her at the Houston Chronicle, which is a newspaper that is seen in these parts on occasion. But her latest work is about what's happening in the Golden State and in California, as we did in Louisiana to a much lesser extent. They have faced these wildfires, and the book is California Burning, and she is here to talk about what's happening and the ongoing implications of an aging utility infrastructure and wildfire risk in the great state of California. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is your assessment of where California is and how this applies to the rest of the country, many states facing similar challenges?
Sure, absolutely. So in California, it's been known that, wildfire risk is a problem. It's historically been most acute in Southern California, but really we see it statewide now. And one thing that I focused on is the role the utilities have had in that and maintaining their infrastructure. All of the utilities are working harder than they ever have before to make sure that their lines don't ignite catastrophic wildfires. But that hasn't always been the case, as we've seen with PG&E, which serves Northern California. Its lines ignited close to 24 deadly fires over the last several years, and more than 100 people died collectively. But the steps that the California utilities are taking really are a lot of other utilities throughout the West are beginning to take note and try to implement some of the same strategies as, you know, drought and climate change continue to be an issue, creating additional wildfire risk in other regions.
Catherine Blunt is the guest. Her voice is relevant on this subject, the author of California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric, and What It Means for America's Power Grid. Now, you were there in Paradise, the fire in that town, Paradise. I remember seeing Governor Jerry Brown and then Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and then President Donald Trump in Northern California. And since then, there have been other wildfires that have been catastrophic. Is this, I hate the term, but is this the new normal in California, or can something be done to avert this?
I think to an extent it's not only the new normal in California, but it's the new normal throughout the West. But things can be done to try to limit the scope of fire, which is unfortunately inevitable when you have you know, long periods of severe drought and tens of millions of dead trees, right? And so there's new efforts to better manage the forest, doing more controlled and prescribed burns so that, you know, you don't have quite as much fuel necessarily, especially in the autumn when the strong winds pick up. And utilities are trying to do more. I mean, again, this is my, you know, my focus, of course, is what they're doing to try to prevent their lines from sparking wildfires. And PG&E, the largest investor-owned utility in California, has been doing a number of different things. One tool that it's relying on very heavily is two things. One, the lines shut off if anything hits them, you know, a tree branch or a squirrel or what have you. And then in the fall, they often proactively cut power when the winds pick up. And this makes the system safer, but it also compromises reliability. So there's a lot of challenges associated with that.
And in Hawaii, you have reported that the Hawaiian electric apparatus was slow to update power lines. Was that the culprit? What was the trigger for what happened there?
Right, right. We don't know officially what ignited the fire that destroyed the town of Lahaina and caused so much devastation there. There are some indications that it may have been Hawaiian electric power lines. ATF and other organizations are trying to figure this out officially, so we will wait to see. But one thing I did do with a couple of colleagues is try to understand how Hawaiian Electric viewed wildfire risk over the last several years. And in 2019, the company made an announcement saying that it was observing PG&E's experience in California and believed that it needed to do more to address this risk. But it wasn't until 2022 that it filed a formal plan to do so with regulators. This plan would have addressed wildfire risk and other climate change related risks. And that proceeding is still pending. So that work hasn't been completed. And, you know, it's easy in hindsight to say a company was moving slowly if we, you know, look at it in the wake of disaster. Unfortunately, the utility regulatory process is by nature pretty slow. But I think if you take a step back, I mean, there's probably real criticism to be made, not just of Hawaiian Electric, but a lot of utilities in the West that don't necessarily have good plans in place for a lot of different aspects of wildfire risk. And they're trying to do so, but the environment continues to change as they make those efforts.
Well, congratulations. Catherine Blunt, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, author of California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric, and What It Means for America's Power Grid. Thank you, Catherine. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And we're joined now by Daryl Urso, who is a Metro councilman and a state representative. People may forget that he actually beat Buddy Amoroso to be elected to the Louisiana House, and tonight he will be the moderator of some major debates at the Woodlawn Baptist Church. The Rotary Club of Southeast Baton Rouge is holding an event there. This is for Louisiana House District 66 and Louisiana Senate District 6. And let's start with the House District. You know some of these people pretty well, don't you, Daryl?
Good morning, and hello to all the listeners. So we are excited about doing this because Southeast Baton Rouge is a very happening part of our community, and both of these races cover a large portion of Southeast Baton Rouge. In House District 66, there are five candidates running: Monique Apening, Emily Chenevere, Hollis Day, Richie Edmonds, and Drew Maranto.
All right, they all will be there, right?
Yes, they're all of the seven candidates, five for the House and two for the Senate.
All right, and some familiar names there.
Right.
And I hate to single out anybody, but a listener, when I previewed that you were here, wanted to know if Richie Edmonds is the other guy. That's a son, right? We got an Edmonds dynasty going on here, right?
So Richie is running to
for his dad's seat, right?
Dad's seat, correct. Right,
this is kind of like J.E. Jumonville back in the day when he took his dad's Senate seat. But Richie Edmonds is not the other Rick Edmonds who is running in the other race, right? Senate District 6.
Senate District 6. So there's two current state representatives in that race, Representative Barry Ivey and Representative Rick Edmonds. Ivey represents District 65 and Edmonds is in 66. So that's an interesting district because it used to go all the way to Tangipahoa and Hammond. And now they've redistricted that, so it's still somewhat of a large area. It covers Lower St. Helena Parish, portions of Livingston, and then East Baton Rouge. So it has three parishes in that boundary, and includes like the Shenandoah area, parts of Old Jefferson in Southeast Baton Rouge. So it will be interesting. That was held by Senator Bodie White for many years, so he was term limited. So that'll be an interesting race to see. That one we know will be decided on Election Day on October 14th.
Yeah, there won't
14th.
Be a runoff with two candidates. One of them will win, and two Republicans, and two well-known Republicans.
Correct.
And I must give Representative Edmonds credit. He beat you in a race.
That's right.
A pretty tough race, as I recall, and yet he's okay with you being the moderator.
Well, you know, you have to do what's right. And with Rotary, you know, we are a nonpartisan organization, so our job is to be a civic as well as a service-oriented group. And we have others who are part of my team to moderate this event tonight. So we are going to, you know, do the best we can, and we're going to treat everyone equally on stage. Everyone has the same opportunity to speak. And like in the presidential debates, when you mention someone else, there's a rebuttal time. We're doing that. We're going to ring the bell when you go over your time. So everything will be timed tonight.
And people are asking why are they running for the Senate? Well, in the old days, people would just stay in one chamber for life if they could. But now with term limits, if you serve 12 years, you got to move to the other chamber. And some of them have even moved back, like Francis Thompson.
He's been there quite a time.
Zigging and zagging and zigging. But Rick Edmonds, another listener notes, didn't he run for Secretary of State? And yes, he did. He lost to Kyle Arndwin. Yeah, 8 years ago, I guess. Or that was a special election.
That was special.
But... But he likes running for office. He's pretty good at it, although he did lose to Kyle Arndwin. But what are the issues in that area that you think are most prominent?
Well, you know, everything is being a Republican area, and you talked about the prior show with the gubernatorial candidates, a lot of taxation. And it was interesting that in LA 23, Libby is talking about an increase in the gas tax.
That's correct.
Interestingly, 8 years ago, I voted to increase the gas tax with a dedicated bridge for East Baton Rouge
and
Parish.
And it cost you your job.
And it cost me my job. So now, 8 years later, we'll have to see
what
happens.
You've got LABI on your side.
Well,
a visionary, Daryl. The thanks you got was that you're now the moderator and the other guys running for the Senate.
Right. But traffic certainly is an issue. Crime, you know, we talk about the budget all the time, you know, the House and the Senate, you have to go in and do the best you can with a limited amount of undesignated revenue in the budget. So there's so much is designated. We're in our 11th state constitution. You know, we've had 10 prior to this one, the last one being the 1921 constitution. It was amended over 500 times in 1921.
Well, we had one in the 70s.
The 74, right, this is the last one. So we're now 48 years operating with this
49.
Current. Yep, this current constitution, and it's been amended over 200 times. So a lot of challenges when you get into the seat. There's a lot of sound bites that you say you're going to do something, but actually sitting there, it's a bit more challenging, and you have to work with the governor as well.
Well, this man was a good public servant. Once he stepped away, and then he got the bug, he came back, he won, and then he lost because he supported a tax, a gas tax, which Steve Carter was promoting, and God yep. bless Steve Carter. Yes, what a fine man he was. Tonight, L.A. House District 66 candidates, L.A. Senate District 6 at the Woodlawn Baptist Church at 7 o'clock.
P.M. Thanks
for listening.